Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. So let me just remind you that here on Connecting Faith, we're trying to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. We're trying to take the headline news of the day, bring the mind of Christ to bear, so we can actually walk that out into the world where we can enter into today's conversations, not just with the right information, but with the right spirit. Like, we can actually bring God's view of things, the kingdom view, into conversation with people who are living in the midst of a kingdom that is operating by very different rules and standards than the kingdom of God. So thank you for joining me in this time today. I actually want to start today by answering a question that that a listener emailed me. So let me just remind you, you can always email me questions really about anything. But if you specifically have a question like about a show or a follow-up to a show, I'm more than happy to seek not only to answer you personally, but if you have a question about something that was talked about on air, my guess is somebody else probably shares that question. And so when I can, like today, I'm going to just answer you on air. And so the question that was raised was in relationship to the conversation that I had last week with John Mock. John Mock is the author of a book called Jesus in the Courtroom. And when I talked with him on Thursday, July the 12th, one of you sent me an email and said, okay, so it would be really helpful if you could actually just tell us the kinds of questions that Christians could use to begin to change the conversation. And what this person was specifically referencing was the sort of screaming back and forth related to the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court of the United States. And the person writing, you know, couched it as a part of the larger conversation about Jesus and the law, God as the lawgiver. And so that's sort of the context of this conversation. So here's the way I'll just summarize the question. You know, how can Christians enter into the conversations that are happening in the culture where people are just screaming back and forth at each other regarding, you know, the specific nomination of the specific judge to be a Supreme Court justice? And so I've come up with four questions that Christians could use to begin to change or redeem that conversation. Number one, I would say, you know, what about just non-defensively entering into the conversation and saying something like this? Well, from your perspective, what are the qualifications for a judge? And then after the person answers, you know, your follow-up could be, well, where does that list of qualifications come from? Or how did you arrive at that particular view of the law? Or how did you arrive at that particular view of what it means to be a judge or to enter a judgment against someone or something, to judge the law? Like, I think that's a good starting point for conversation, because you've backed off of the question about personality. You have completely backed away from the conversation about political party affiliation and whether or not this is a red or blue debate in our country. And then as a Christian, you can then, after they have given you their answer and assessment of what the qualifications for a judge are, or, you know, how to judge the judge, you could say something like, so this is just me, right? So when I think about a judge, I think ultimately about God. The Declaration of Independence actually bears witness to the foundation of natural law, a law that's set in human hearts by the lawgiver, and that lawgiver is God. So your reference here is actually the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Now, first of all, to say that someone is endowed by the Creator suggests what? Well, that there's a Creator, and that Creator has endowed us with something. That's the natural rights language. And so what is the natural rights or the natural law language? Well, it's the language related to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so another way to follow up would be this. Well, when I think about judges, I actually think about a guy named Solomon. Solomon is a guy in the Bible, and he wrote the books of Proverbs and a book called Ecclesiastes. He was one of the kings of Israel. He actually is the guy who built the temple in Jerusalem. But he was also a judge, and he showed incredibly good judgment. And his good judgment was actually based upon the gift of wisdom from God. Like, Solomon knew that he did not know how to judge rightly, so he asked God for wisdom. And then in addition to giving him wisdom, God actually gave Solomon a lot of other stuff. And it's like a really cool story. And maybe we could actually look at that together if that's something you're interested in doing. So it seems to me that wisdom is the chief characteristic of a good judge. And if you and your conversation partner can get to the place where you're talking about wisdom, then you're sort of on your home turf, because Christians can certainly enter into a conversation about wisdom that other people cannot enter in. I mean, that's our territory. That's our terrain. Wisdom is something that is dealt with throughout the scriptures, and wisdom is something that's bestowed by God. It's not just knowledge. It's not just a head knowledge. There's a wisdom that comes from knowing God that gives us the righteous mind of Christ. And there's a lot of people who can't think rightly because, frankly, they're out of their minds. And that would be a Romans 2 conversation for, I'm not suggesting that you have the Romans 2 conversation with your neighbor, but that is where that conversation would ultimately lead. All right, here's another way you could go in the conversation about judging the judge, Brett Kavanaugh, who is the nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. So what does it mean to show good judgment? And how are we to judge whether or not Brett Kavanaugh would be a good judge? You know, everybody's making judgment calls all the time. And moment by moment, decision making requires judgment. We actually judge whether or not a person shows good judgment by the outcome or consequence of their decisions. So what are the outcomes of Judge Kavanaugh's decisions to this point that concern you? So now what you're doing in the conversation is you are establishing, you're establishing a reference point, and that reference point is we can judge the judge based on the way the judge has judged in the past. Has this judge shown good judgment? And how are we going to judge what is good judgment and what is not good judgment, which is ultimately the conversation about what is good? And how are you going to decide what is good? Well, that is an excellent conversation for Christians to engage in, because goodness is one of the three transcendental virtues, along with beauty and truth. Goodness is a character quality of God. And so ultimately the question of good or bad judgment is going to come down to how you define good and bad. And now we're talking about massive moral categories. And now we're talking about worldview. And if a person does not believe that there is a God, they don't believe in a personal universe, then how are they making moral decisions? And if they're making moral decisions just by putting their finger into the wind of the day, then would they, that's just groupthink. That's mob mentality. We like to call it democracy, but there's no difference really at that level in democracy and mob mentality. And so we've got to be basing judgment on something or the question of what is good or bad judgment based on something other than just the shifting winds or the shifting sands of our time. All right, quickly, a couple other questions that Christians can ask to change or reframe the conversation of the day on this particular front. You could say, hey, is the Constitution, I realize there's two views of this, but let me ask you personally, do you think the Constitution is a living document, or should it be interpreted by the justices of the Supreme Court in alignment with its original meaning and intent? So this is the conversation about original intent or textualism versus treating the Constitution as a living document and the justices actually legislating from the bench. Your follow-up question could be, hey, how does that compare to how you interpret the Bible as a Christian? You're going to get into a really rich conversation if you go that way. All right, one more question, and then I got to take a quick break. Your question could be, well, have you ever been to court and stood in front of a judge? That might lead you into a really robust conversation about the reality that one day we're going to all stand before the judgment seat of God. I'm happy that I will be standing there not under self-representation, but with Jesus. He will be pleading my case. He will be covering for me. And so we don't want people representing themselves in that case. All right, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to have a conversation with Mateen Alas about Islam. This is a conversation that you're not going to want to miss. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am joined today by Dr. Mateen Elas. Mateen is an Arab Reformed theologian and the author of Jesus and Muhammad and Understanding the Quran, a quick Christian guide to the Muslim holy book. He blogs at mateenelas.wordpress.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Mateen Elas and on Facebook at Mateen Elas Ministry. Mateen, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it's so good to be with you.
So I have known you a long time, and I really think that it would be a benefit for people to simply hear your story. So you're an Arab, but you're a Christian. A lot of people don't even understand what that even means. So can you just start there?
Sure. Yeah, sure. I was born to a Syrian Muslim father and an American Roman Catholic mother, and then raised overseas in Saudi Arabia. My father was, as a young man, was a practicing Muslim, but as he got older and became more and more westernized, he also grew more secular. So we were raised pretty much in a secular home, but of course in the midst of a very, very conservative Muslim environment, Wahhabi Islam. My dad and mom both said that as we grew older, they would honor whatever decisions we made as far as our belief systems. And I had quite a journey from around age 13 onwards, moving away from Islam and towards the practice of classical yoga. Spent some time in India in an ashram, studying under one particular guru, was licensed to teach classical yoga. And I mention that because my dad, in all that time, had no problems with my religious pursuits. But at age 20, I had quite a dramatic encounter with Christ and became an avid follower of his, and went home that Christmas vacation, 1975, from college, and told my father, as I'd shared with him always about my religious pursuits, that I had become a Christian. And suddenly that was not okay. He exploded, and we had some very emotional arguments over about a four-day period before he finally just shut down and wouldn't have anything more to do with me, ended up kicking me out of the family. And that lasted about not quite 15 years. All of that, interestingly, because for some reason it was unacceptable for him for me to become a Christian, although any other pursuit would have apparently been fine. And it was a hard road for me to figure out what had happened and how I could relate to my father. And fortunately, after about 15 years, God's grace was working in my dad's heart, and he slowly welcomed us, my wife Cindy and our kids and me, back into the larger family.
All right, so let's talk about, you know, for folks who are listening and they're saying to themselves, I don't know that I could give up my family. Talk about your love of Christ. Like, talk about why coming to know Christ, having clearly been raised in a religion other than Christianity and having explored other options as well. What is so unique about Jesus that you found him irresistible enough that, you know, you'd stick with Jesus instead of just simply returning to your father's home?
Well, you hit the nail on the head with the adjective irresistible. I had done quite a bit of research and study, not academic research, but research driven by my own hunger to discover whether there was something at the center of the universe or someone that I was supposed to give my life to follow. And, of course, I had looked quite extensively at Islam, but when I left and started looking at Eastern mysticism, I did quite a bit of study of individual world religion leaders, as well as the resource materials that are sacred to the various traditions of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, even looked at Zoroastrianism and Jainism. But it wasn't until I started reading the Gospels, which I'd never done until age 20, that I was just captivated by the person of Jesus that they present. And I remember as I was coming up for air after I finished the Gospel of John, I read the four Gospels in a span of about 3 days, just mesmerized. And I remembered thinking at that time, this guy, Jesus, stands head and shoulders above anyone I've studied or wondered about following. And if he were alive today, I would go and find him and ask him if he would take me as a student. Of course, I was thinking in my guru student days of that kind of a relationship. And of course, in the end, that's what it really means to be a disciple in the New Testament sense, to be a student of Jesus. So for me, the big question before I became a Christian was, is it likely that the resurrection really happened? Because if it did happen, then I reasoned that it would be possible to speak to Jesus today and ask him if he would take me as a follower of his. He might not answer me, but if the resurrection really happened, then he was now alive, never to die again, and able to move beyond the boundaries of space and time, then why couldn't I just openly ask him and hope that he would hear me and respond? And so ultimately that's what I did after quite a bit of wrestling over the question. And then that one particular night, September 15th, 1975, I bowed and prayed, and Christ made himself known to me in a very personal, real way. And I've been a follower of his ever since, never claiming that I've followed him very well, but always claiming that he is the only one worth following.
Amen. So in your growing up, you describe Wahhabism, and I think that probably there are a lot of people listening who have only heard that as a passing reference in the news. So can you tell us, you know, because it's fairly unique to Saudi Arabia, I think. So what is Wahhabism?
Yes, that's true. Wahhabism is named after a fellow named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab from the 1700s, who was a religious scholar. And he teamed up with the earliest scion of the Saud family, and the two of them together, he being the religious scholar and Saud being the political military leader, decided to try to forge an allegiance to tame the Arabian Peninsula and bring it under one leading approach. And so they did, and Wahhabism is a very strict interpretation, almost literalist interpretation of the Quran and Sunnah. The word Sunnah means the traditions of Muhammad, his lifestyle and his practices and teachings. So together the Quran and the Sunnah formulate for conservative Muslims the core of what they believe and what they think that they're supposed to practice. So Wahhabism is really, it's unique, pretty much unique to the Arabian Peninsula. It's the Islam that is official for the Saudi government. But the same kind of approach is found in other named aspects of Islam. So you hear, for instance, of the Salafis. They're a group who say that Muhammad and then the first three generations of Muslims after Muhammad were the ones who got it right. So everyone needs to follow the lead of those individuals. And then the Muslim Brotherhood, which originated in Egypt and has spread to numerous places around the world, particularly throughout the Middle East, but also now here in the United States. And they have a very similar kind of conservative Islamic worldview. And of course, most famously or infamously, in the recent past is ISIS. Really, I don't see a significant difference philosophically between ISIS and Wahhabism. The one significant difference is the ISIS folks were willing to carry out all of the behaviors in terms of punishments and restrictions that Wahhabis aren't quite so intent on carrying out within their own society.
So I think people hearing you describe it that way are now thinking to themselves, but I thought Saudi Arabia was our friend, and that doesn't sound like a super friendly religious approach to life. So is Islam just a religion? Because it sure does sound like you are describing something that is more than a religion.
Well, of course, it all depends on how you define the term religion. And to go back to your initial assessment that saying politics makes strange bedfellows certainly applies to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia when it comes to realpolitik in the world today. But Islam is a whole code of life. One of the things that many Christians have a hard time grasping is, at least Western Christians, is that Islam is first and foremost a communal religion, and secondarily, it's an individual pursuit. So when you become a Muslim, or if you're raised as a Muslim, you're raised as part of a community, and the community's life takes priority over your individual life. So for Orthodox Muslims, practicing Muslims, Sharia law, which is a law that's not binding just on individuals, but is meant to be binding on certainly on the Muslim world community, and according to Muslim theology, it's meant to be binding on the whole world, whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, that takes priority over everything else. So, yeah, Islam controls every aspect of your life. Of course, if you're a disciple of Jesus and you're fully committed to him as he commands us to be, his will is supreme for everything, every part of our life as well. But it's one thing to have a commitment that is based on a personal relationship with God. It's a second, other, it's a completely other thing to have a commitment that's based on following a strict set of laws that are comprehensive in life.
All right, friends, we've got to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to actually continue this conversation, and I'm going to ask Mateen to give us a course in Islam. I'm going to ask him to come up with, like, I don't know, five things American Christians need to know and understand about Islam. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm Carmen LaBerge. All right, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. I'm continuing my conversation today with Dr. Mateen Elass. You can follow him on Twitter at Mateen Elass, that's E-L-A-S-S, or at Mateen Elass Ministry on Facebook. He blogs regularly at mateenelass.wordpress.com, and his books include Jesus and Muhammad and Understanding the Quran, A Quick Christian Guide to the Muslim Holy Book. All right, Mateen, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I told you before the break I was going to ask you to give us five things American Christians need to know and understand about Islam. So I'm just going to let you answer that question.
Okay, Carmen. Thanks so much. Well, I think one of the most common questions I get as I go around the country teaching on Islam is, we hear that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. Is that true? And if so, why is it the case? So let me start with trying to answer that question. Statistically speaking, it is true that Islam is the fastest growing religion around the world. The primary reason for that is birth rate. Islam counts as Muslims any child that is born to a Muslim couple. And so if you have a especially in the third world, a situation where Muslims are procreating at population, the non-Muslim population around the world, it stands for Islam would be growing very fast. The conversion rate into Islam is much, much less than most people are led to believe. And here in the United States, the element that contributes to Islam being such a fast-growing religion is primarily immigration first, and then second birth rate, and then third conversion rate. One of the things that's not mentioned, and I'll bring this up during point number five, is that there's are no statistics that are kept in Muslim circles on the people who voluntarily leave Islam. So that that number is very hazy in Muslim eyes for those who are involved in missions to the Muslim world, Christians who are involved in that. The numbers are more quantifiable, but still rather mysterious because, as most people know, if you're a Muslim and you want to leave Islam and you make that publicly known and you live in a Muslim-dominated society, your life will be in danger. So many sort of defect in place and don't say very much. So fastest growing religion, on the one hand, statistically, if you look at that, yeah, it's true. On the other hand, when you look more deeply into the numbers, it's not true. The second point I'd say about Islam is that to really understand Islam beyond the five pillars of the faith, which most people are aware of, you need to know that the life of Muhammad is key to making sense of Islam. Every decree or teaching about Islam ultimately goes back to Muhammad, either his own teachings or his own practices, his own example, as those examples have been collected in what is known as the Hadith traditions material about Muhammad. You can read the Quran until you're blue in the face and not understand it very much, until you know something of the life and career of Muhammad, because the Quran is not like the Bible. It does not have much historical grounding in the text. So you're reading all of these pieces of material in the Quran, but you're not sure how they relate to some real event in history. Until you know the life of Muhammad, and then you can see how some saying that he gives as the word of Allah has relevance in the situation that he's in. But you don't know that situation just from reading the Quran. You have to know the background. Understand Islam. The third point is, as I mentioned in the last segment, Sharia law is preeminent for Orthodox Muslims, practicing Muslims, or observant Muslims, you might say. Their goal is to see Sharia law enshrined in every government around the world until the whole world, ideally for them, becomes one community, which is ruled by the Sharia law, which Muslims believe is the literal laws of Allah given for the human race. Fourth, it's important for Christians to know that Islam is consciously and intentionally an anti-Christian religion. It stands to reason because, of course, it arose in the early 600s. 610 AD is the date that is given as Muhammad's first revelation. For Muhammad to succeed as a prophet, he had to be able to justify his existence or his role as a prophet. In order to do that, he had to downgrade Jesus, because if Jesus is the Son of God, then a prophet can't trump Jesus' words. As we read in Hebrews chapter 1, and many times and places, God spoke of old by his prophets, but now he has spoken to us by his Son. So the Son trumps all others. So Muhammad had to somehow be able to demote Jesus while at the same time trying not to completely badmouth Jesus. And so Islam makes Jesus into a great prophet, but it denies that he is the Son of God. It denies that he is divine, denies his lordship over all, and says that he is only human, and he's only a prophet, even though a great prophet. And at the same time, secondly, Islam denies the crucifixion. The Quran, in only one place, speaks about the crucifixion in the fourth surah and says pointedly that the Jews thought they had crucified Jesus, but they were mistaken. They did not crucify him. And instead, Islam teaches that Jesus was, in essence, raptured up to heaven before he could be crucified, and that he is now up in heaven, either in a state of suspended animation or twiddling his thumbs or playing solitaire or something, until Allah gives the decree that Jesus should return to the world, at which time, according to Islamic teaching, he will return, become the head of the Islamic community, and then spread Islam over the face of the whole earth, and then rule until he dies, and at his death, that will signal the judgment day to come. So no crucifixion, which means no atonement. Islam has no savior figure. It's a religion of merit-based works, not a religion of grace. And so every Muslim has to stand or fall, or every human being has to stand or fall on the basis of his or her own good works or bad works. And of course, since Islam denies the Trinity, or denies Jesus' divinity, it denies the Trinity. They're not three persons in one essence. There's only this Unitarian God, and he rules sovereignly over all things. And then the fifth point, coming back to Islam as the fastest growing religion, what most people don't know is that Islam as a system is leaking adherence like a sieve. As Muslims today have an opportunity that they never had in prior generations to be able to read and study the world's religions or philosophical beliefs on their own. They can get on the internet or through social media, through their smartphone. There are all sorts of means now where, in the privacy of their own home, they can research, find out what they want to learn about life. They're not dependent upon their imam to tell them about what Christianity really is all about or whatever. And so Muslims today are being confronted by all of the different belief systems of the world that they never knew about before, or at least never had access to learning about fully. And they're realizing that the world has a lot more to say than just what Islam has taught. And they're learning that the message of the gospel is a lot different than what they were taught it was under their Islamic schools or under their imams or sheikhs. And so many Muslims are saying, we want nothing more to do with Islam. And this is particularly true in the more repressive countries like Iran and the Gulf countries of the Middle East. The fastest growing church, percentage-wise, in the world today is per country is found in Iran. And one of the primary reasons is Iranians say if what we're living under now is what Islam is meant to produce, we don't want anything to do with Islam anymore. We want something else. And the church in Iran, the house church movement, is just booming, as it is beginning to do in other parts of the Muslim world, especially in parts of North Africa and in the Gulf countries. So exciting things are happening. And if truth could be told accurately, we'd see that the number of people leaving Islam is astonishing. The figures that I'm best aware of is that about 80%, this is from Iranian sources, about 80% of the country would rather that the theocracy be overthrown and a secular government be installed. And of the people that are leaving Islam in both Iran and in Egypt, there's about one out of six who are leaving that are leaving to become followers of Christ. Five out of that six are leaving just to become atheists. And when you understand Islam, the Muslim mindset, you can understand that, because Muslims are saying, we've been taught that Islam is the be-all and end-all. It's the final revelation. And then if they come to the conclusion that it's not true, they think naturally that all other religions must be false if Islam is false. So they turn to atheism. But
so,
after 2 years, many... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, that's okay. I think we're going to have to leave it here for today, and then we're going to have you back, because I think there's so much soil to be tilled in this conversation. So, Mateen Elas, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith. For those of you who are listening, I'll be right back to make the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm guessing that you wish you had had pen and paper out for that conversation with Mateen Elas on Islam. And if you've got follow-up questions for Mateen and for me, or for me in relationship to that conversation, would you email me? My email address is carmen@myfaithradio.com. And here I want to make the connecting point. So here's the challenge, I think, that or one of the challenges that we face as Christians in a pluralistic culture. We recognize that Islam is actually on the rise. It's the fastest growing religion in the world. If trends continue at their current rate and in the current direction, Islam will actually be the majority religion globally by like 2060. That's 6-0. And so, where Christianity has enjoyed majority religion status around the globe for a number of centuries, we are, at least based on current trends, you know, we are headed toward minority faith status globally, with Islam moving rapidly forward as a much more, you know, I'm going to use the word evangelistic here, because it just, in terms of not only conversions, but it's based, according to Pew and Gallup, this is really based on the numbers of babies that people who are committed to the Islamic faith, they're having a lot more babies than people who are committed to the Christian faith. So part of this is what I call natural evangelism, which means having your own. But part of this is also conversion evangelism. And obviously, the conversations that we have had here on prior occasions about things like the Great Opportunity, which I'll remind you is at greatopportunity.org, you know, really seeking to call people back to church planting and traditional evangelism. Like, we have to recognize that in every generation, in every nation under heaven, Christianity and every other variety of religion is always and everywhere only one generation away from becoming less influential and, yes, even I'll use the word here, extinct. Now, you and I both know Christ has promised that his church is going to prevail and that the gates of hell even will not prevail against it. And so it's not like I'm talking about worrying or saying that the sky is falling. But it's definitely different living in a world populated by more and more people who are aggressively disinterested, be the way I'll frame that, in Christianity, and who think that Christianity and Judaism, for that matter, should be eliminated. So I thought I would make you all tend to like, you respond positively when I give you a list of things. And so I thought that today in the connecting point here at the end of the hour, I would share with you just kind of a list of things that other folks are saying every Christian should know about Islam. So it is a fast growing religion, especially in the Western world. And I think that Christians increasingly need to be aware not only of Islam, but how to engage with people of Muslim tradition and Islamic faith. How do we engage with them? So this list was actually generated by in conversation with Mateen and in conversation with a person who spent 20 years as a missionary in a Muslim-majority country. So I'm going to start with Muslim is a religious term, but it doesn't mean the same thing as being Arab. And for those of us who know, Arab Christians, Arabic-speaking Christians, all the ancient Orthodox Christian churches, this is obviously something that we're very well aware of, that there are people who are Arabs who are not Muslim. And then second, the word Islam just means submission. So a Muslim is someone who submits to Allah. And the Islamic conception of who God is based on the teaching of a guy named Muhammad. And so the Islamic creed is there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That's called the Shahada, and that is required to be written in Arabic. And we could talk on another occasion about the use of that actually in public schools in America as an art exercise, and where, you know, kids in public school have been writing this Islamic phrase in art class, not knowing what they were writing. And people of Islamic faith have been they've been pleased at the influence they've been able to have on that front. But I digress. Okay, there are two major denominations of Muslims. Mateen already addressed this, but it's Sunni and Shia. Sunnis are the vast majority, or 85% of all Muslims. And then let's move to Islamic theology. Islamic theology can really be summarized as belief in one God, Allah, his prophet, his book, his angels, his decrees, and the final judgment that he brings. So unlike Christianity, Islam teaches that human beings are born spiritually neutral, perfectly capable of either obeying God's requirements completely, and therefore like always remaining in perfect relationship with God, or not doing that, in which case they need to work themselves. I mean, it's a works-based religion. There's no grace, and there's certainly no savior. Islam teaches that Jesus was a great prophet. It does affirm that Jesus was born of a virgin and lived a sinless life and performed miracles, and that he came again, that he will come again at the end of history. They call him a word from God, but they explicitly deny his deity. They do not regard him as God. They repudiate the title the Son of God. They repudiate that as blasphemous. And they also deny that he died on the cross. There's significant departures from Christianity in Islam, obviously. Islamic practice can be summarized by the five pillars of Islam. So those are composed of the confession of faith, which, again, is the Shahada. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Prayer, which these ritual prayers are said in Arabic five times a day while facing Mecca. There are these prescribed sets of bowings and kneelings and prostrations that are included in the prayers. The giving of alms, and the alms are taken actually as a tax in some officially Islamic countries. Fasting, so the lunar month of Ramadan, which is a time during which Muslim believers fast during daylight hours, but eat during the hours of darkness. So that's one of the five pillars. And then pilgrimage, the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, which every Muslim believer is supposed to make at least once in his or her lifetime. So seventh on the list is the vast majority of Muslims are not what we would consider terrorists, right? Normal Islamic religious law actually forbids the intentional killing of non-combatants in battle. It also forbids suicide. So when we talk about radical jihadi Muslim terrorists, we're talking about a very small minority of people and a very small minority view. But you and I also both know it only takes one radicalized individual to wreak great havoc. And so although it's a small minority, it has a tremendous impact when we're talking about terrorism around the globe. Eighth on the list would be Muslims, frankly, some of the friendliest, certainly most hospitable people that you will ever meet. And so if there are Muslims in your community, maybe who have immigrated there, I would really encourage you to be gracious and reach out. Go and meet your neighbors. In all likelihood, you will be invited into their home, which is not only a great honor, but the hospitality that you will enjoy will be tremendous. And you and I both know, we both know this. Table fellowship is a rich opportunity to really get to know people. And so you need to invite your Muslim neighbors into your home, and you need to go when invited into their home. Don't hesitate to accept the invitation for table fellowship. Indeed, Christ can be made known in the breaking of bread. There's no question that Muslims need salvation through Jesus Christ. And so to buy into the contemporary lie that all religions lead to the same place and all religions lead to the same outcome is simply false. So Muslims are lost in much the same way, in fact, exactly the same way that every other non-Christian is lost. Neither more nor less than any other lost person. A Muslim is neither more lost nor less lost than a prodigal child raised in a Christian home. But until and unless Muslims come to faith in Jesus Christ, they're not saved. And so the efforts that have been put into resources and equipping related to how Christians can engage with Muslims, with our Muslim neighbors, in conversations about Jesus, and then ultimately in conversations about giving their lives to Jesus, is really significant. And there's a ton of stuff available online in terms of equipping for those particular conversations, and I would encourage you to take advantage of those. But it starts by praying. And if you and I are not praying for God to reveal himself in dreams to Muslims, we should be, because it would not surprise a Muslim for God to come to them in a dream. What would surprise them is that God would be Jesus. And so we should be praying actively and ardently that God would miraculously reveal himself, and that then we would be standing ready to explain to people what they had seen and heard and introduce them to Jesus, whose name they know, but whose character and work they very badly misunderstand. And then finally, I think we need to absolutely recognize that, you know, God loves Muslims, and so should we. And so we have to have at least enough love to pray for them and to care for them and to share the gospel with them. We need to love them enough to make them welcome in our homes, and we need to love them enough to not leave them where they are in their sin. And so, friends, again, I want to entertain any questions that you might have in relationship to Islam. I may not know the answers, but I can certainly track down the answers, and you could email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You could let me know what you're thinking about these things, where you think I have missed a point that needs to be lifted up. And you could also share with me resources that have been helpful for you or things that you're using in your church to reach your Muslim neighbors. I would love to know what those resources are. So again, send me an email at Carmen@myfaithradio.com. All right, friends, that is about all the time we have today. Let me remind you to share today's show with somebody else. You can do that by going to myfaithradio.com and clicking on the Connecting Faith page, and then actually just share the audio link. If you have never visited me at my ministry website, it's called reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'd love it if you would visit me there. And if you would sign up for the weekly email, that would be terrific. That's a great way for you to be reminded of what we've been talking about, not only here on the show, but to read the blogs that I post and also engage in substantive conversation about the things that we discuss here on Connecting Faith and the headlines that go beyond what we have time to talk about here. So again, thank you for joining me here on Connecting Faith. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.